Thank you, John. I thought somehow you were going to say that you knew that most of my radio presentations over the last decade had been 30 seconds long, and you were wishing for that this morning. And actually, one can say a great deal in 30 seconds. The 23rd Psalm is 30 seconds long, and it's difficult to improve on that. But I'm afraid I'll run a tad longer than that. So many warm feelings wash over one when over me this morning as I arrive here and see people here who have been co-travelers, people here who have been my chief administrator, like Henry Petker, people here who have been my teachers, like many of the students at Elkhart, many others who have been friends, and it's a great privilege to be here. Translation is such a fascinating task, and when I wrote out the titles of what I wanted to speak on and gave them by telephone or by note, because I got it back in handwritten form. I brought it along just to reassure myself. Gave them to my secretary, who is Chinese, and she typed them, and I think sent them by fax to Professor Huebner. By the time it got here, the word context had turned into the word concept, and I have no way of knowing how that took place. So we're going to talk about the virtue of presence and the church as a context of healing, but concept might work. I thought Harry Huebner had done that because he's a philosopher, right? You were working on Kant at one time, weren't you? And Kant said there is no percept without concept, and no concept without percept, right? So it was very perceptive of you to put concept there. And I thank you. However that happened, I'm sure it is strange in a Christian gathering to begin with the opening story coming from that unusual, cynical, and ironic writer, Kurt Vonnegut. But I'm going to risk that with one of his brief stories that illustrates something of where we are yet in the 90s, even though he wrote it back two decades ago. Once upon a time, he said, on Tralfamador, a distant planet, there were creatures who weren't anything like machines. They weren't dependable. They weren't efficient. They weren't predictable. They weren't durable. And these poor creatures were obsessed by the idea that everything that existed had to have a purpose, and that some purposes were higher than others. And these creatures spent most of their time trying to find out what their purpose was. And every time they found out what seemed to be a purpose of themselves, the purpose seemed so low that the creatures were filled with disgust and shame. And rather than serve such a low purpose, the creatures would make a machine to serve it. And this left the creatures free to seek and serve higher purposes. But whenever they found a higher purpose, the purpose still wasn't high enough. So machines were made to serve the higher purposes too. And the machines did everything so expertly that they were finally given the job of finding out what the highest purpose of these creatures should be. And the machines reported that in all honesty, that the creatures couldn't really be said to have any purpose at all. And the creatures thereupon began slaying each other because they hated purposeless things above all else. And they discovered that they weren't even very good at slaying. And so they turned that job over to the machines too. And the machines finished up the job in less time than it takes to say, Tralfamador. Oh, what a parable of alienation, of purposelessness, of life gone fragmented. Rabbi Naaman of Breslov, according to Elie Wiesel, one of the great Hasidic writers, 1772 to 1810, left us a tale which is quite different and very timeless and yet very similar. Compare them. Once upon a time, there was a king who knew that the next harvest would be cursed, and whoever would eat the grain from it would go mad. And so he ordered an enormous granary built and stored there all that remained from the last crop. And he entrusted the key to his friend, and this is what he told him. When my subjects and their king are struck with madness, you alone have the right to enter the storehouse and eat uncontaminated food, and thus you will escape the curse, the malediction. But in exchange, your mission will be to cover the earth, going from country to country, from town to town, telling tales, telling our stories of life and its meaning. And you will shout with all your might, good people, do not forget. What is at stake is your life, your survival. Do not forget. Do not forget. Now you already suspect that I am beginning to talk about the fragmentation, the context to which we go as people who offer some invitation and some support and some shepherding that invites toward healing and toward maturing. And to speak of that now at this age as we end a century is a bit courageous, because every age considers itself to be extraordinary, and those that come at the hinge of millennia usually see themselves to be particularly extraordinary. They have some illusion of uniqueness, and so do we. We have begun to describe our thought today as postmodern. We are at a turning point and no longer a part of the modern age which has preceded us, that we live in a watershed of human experience, a new world order, the end of modernity, the beginning of postmodernity. And we humbly confess that we are clearly the hinge of history. Well, that seems like a rather contradictory phrase to talk of postmodernity. We're not completely sure what modernity is. We've been using the word now for quite a long time. And to designate this period in which such relativity and such variety and such different social locations and such different perspectives have become so overwhelming that we can no longer have a common modern perspective is difficult. So let's begin for a moment by talking about where we are coming from as we approach an age in which we suggest that even the cultural world is fragmenting into highly relative subunits with little in common and little to link them around an entire globe. We've been living in the last century what we might well call the age of autonomy. Actually, it's several centuries old. The post-Enlightenment vision and understanding of persons as no longer identified collectively by family, community, or social group, but by their own individual, autonomous, unique, and separate and clear identity. Langdon Gilkey, the philosopher, theologian, writes, "The source of whatever optimism and courage the modern spirit possesses is autonomy. And autonomy places the human solely on his or her own. We are set in a context indifferent to our deepest purposes, so that whatever hope and meaning there is to be found has to come from within. We must know our own truth, decide our own existence, create our own meaning, establish our own values. We are self-creating, self-directing, free beings. If it believes anything at all, the modern spirit holds that we must in some essential regard live our lives in autonomy if that life is to be creative and human and triumph over destiny by exercising the freedom to master fate." Well, the autonomous individual has been described in so many different ways. If I were to string them all together, to cite together the language that has been used by commentators such as Peter Berger or Christopher Leisch or Robert Bella or Stanley Hauerwas, who has been here, Martin Gross, Alan Bloom, we would say that the autonomous individual at the end of this century is a homeless, fragmented, narcissistic, a preferential, that is choosing values by preference, not because they are good, but because you prefer them, cybernetic with extension from the computer process, highly strategic, and quite closed mind. Wonderful description of Californians, but perhaps it does affect people in Canada as well. Well, I describe with those words because I would say it's homeless, because people are asking, where do I belong? Fragmented, what is my center? How do I know what is my center and from where do I choose my values? Narcissistic, because what really matters is me. Preferential, because I choose the things that are good because, well, they're good because I say they're good, not because they are good apart from me. Cybernetic, that I'm an extension of my computer and I don't need my memory because it's all there in the floppy disk. Strategic, because I have to be the one who plans and defines and determines my own life. And closed, because openness to everything, that is, cultural relativity, has numbed us to discerning value, paralyzed our capacity to choose, and then that inevitably closes the mind. Without firm core values, we're unable to make meaningful choices, and so we cling to what we do have. What I've just described affects our lifestyles far more than we often want to admit. It affects mine, living in a major urban context. Because the qualities of modernity that shape our personalities, shape our sense of who we are and the limited connections we have with other people, that shape our social structures and shape the institutions such as family, congregation, and the political household of the nation, well, they take on many different forms. Let me just use a few quotes that I hear from students in the last year at the seminary where I teach in California. And I'll just pick up the key elements that describe this modernity I've phrased. Relativity. I hear a student say, "I'm not sure I want to go to class today. If I lose the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch from Jim Butler's teaching, I have nothing absolute left. I'll give up on faith. I'll give up on the ministry. I'll give up on the church, and I'm out of here. Oh, if there's nothing much left to hold one's life together, how can you challenge anything that has been previously precious to you? Mobility. A student said, where do I come from? Really nowhere. I've never lived anywhere longer than 3 years. I have no roots. I'm truly a rootless person. Well, I hope they've grown bulbs that they can take with them, because one needs some sustenance. Or mobility, I've just described pluralism. I have to choose what's right for me. You have to choose what's right for you. As a student said that insistently at the end of a discussion on campus, I was remembering a Mennonite chaplain who told me that there was a time when Mennonite students came to Mennonite College as being thoroughly versed in the scripture, that they were extremely at home in the biblical world. But he said, today there's one single verse you can count on everyone knowing. Every student who comes will know this verse. Judge not that ye be not judged. That's, again, pluralism. We're going to have to accept everybody and make no judgments of others. Individuation. I heard a California student say, what I've learned from therapy is I don't care what the church asks of me or expects of me. I've got to be me. That's the important thing I've gained. Or specialization, in which a student says, I feel like I'm learning so much about things that mean so little, so I can cite all of the uses of gar with the subjunctive in the New Testament. But what is it that I really know about life? Or functionalism. A student says, I came to seminary in midlife because I'm tired of being a function. I want to be a person. I was a cog. I was a replaceable part in the industry I worked for. I was not a significant human, and now I'm trying to find, is it possible for me to be a significant human here in an academic setting? Or rationality. A student said, I live by schedule. I follow my checklist. I computerize my budget and appointments. I collect my voicemail. I coordinate my career with my spouses. I'm an administrative marvel. But I do it all by a clear, rational definition. Or abstraction, that my life is shaped by decisions made somewhere by someone I'll never meet. Corporate structures, multinational corporations, television programmers, designers, advertisers, even denominational executives. Who are they? Where are they? And why do they have the right to shape my life? Or uncertainty. Right now I'm between jobs, between two recent moves and my next one. I'm totally confused as to where I'm going and I'm scared. Or futurity. That is, I'm told I should have my life plan, my goals set, my strategies for success operational to impose control in the future, to achieve the dream of the West in the century that's supposed to be ours, but I don't know about the future. Well, we could go on to describe fragility, interiority, what really matters within, or pluralism. But to pick up the ones that matter most in the descriptions I observe and in the lives I see and in the people I counsel, they would be the keywords of pluralism, relativity, specialization, and futurity, living out of the future. And let me say just a couple comments about those. In pluralism, where the traditional society affirmed that there were convictions and institutions that mattered, modernity offers a culturally diverse, radically heterogeneous plethora of groups and faiths and values and worldviews and lifestyles. There are great discrepancies in value systems, incredible belief structures, unconventional lifestyles, inexplicable behaviors. And in the face of all those, our absolute convictions about things are challenged constantly and repeatedly. I teach on a campus where there are about 75 to 78 different ethnic groups this year, and over 80-some different denominations you've never heard of. And so when I attend a class like yesterday morning with 125 students, I look across the class and begin lecturing on family systems and family relationships, and I realize the variety of family units that these students have grown up in is so incredibly diverse. So with all of that variety, one is always asking, how in the midst of this pluralism do I find a way to offer something that helps people connect and helps them to reunite? Of course, there lies the central part of what we're about in pastoral care, connecting and reconnecting for persons. Because in pluralism, we find that the incredible complementarity and the dignity of persons in the midst of all the diversity can lead us to come to embrace one another and build together connectedness that forms what our dream is the body of Christ, or that we can see people tolerating and distancing from each other and failing to connect and communicate. Relativity is the second one, where once upon a time, beliefs had a transcendent viewpoint, centering point, and where we could say, here's where we begin with our perceptions and with our values. Now, instead of that, the enlightened person in a value-free modernity believes that human beliefs that are fragile and need constant confirmation by conversation with other people, interaction, to be plausible, that we've found everything floating so much more freely. And so when one no longer lives in a social network that certifies one's beliefs, so what Peter Berger, the theologian sociologist, calls a plausibility structure, then all becomes relative and the structure is shifting. He talks about thick plausibility structures that are well connected to each other. That would be the Mennonite community I grew up in Western Ohio, and where you needed little theology because an ethic was enough to keep you well connected to each other. And so we lived more on the basis of an ethic than on the basis of a theology. In contrast, where I live in California, people have to have a very clear theology but often have minimal ethics because they need some kind of a structure to believe, something to live by. Paul Hebert, the Mennonite anthropologist who used to teach at Fuller and has left, says that what happens for us as we are thrust into this period is that we are pushed into the fluid river of relativity, and we find that we must tread water to try and keep afloat. And so we swim in a highly fluid context which has little that is absolute. He says that happens particularly when we are plunged into multicultural situations, because every cross-cultural encounter is by nature the case relativizing, and we realize that what was absolute on one side of the Pyrenees is not absolute on the other side of the Pyrenees, that it's significantly different. But he says the goal of this is not to keep us treading water for the rest of our lives, but to teach us to swim so that we can arrive at the far bank and we can climb out and once more be able to talk about absolutes, about values, about profound commitments, about things that endure. But we do it with a different tone of voice, with a different perspective, with a new resilience and a new flexibility that allows us to affirm what is absolute but no longer assert that my grasp of that absolute is absolute, so that there's a humility in the midst of that dialogue on that. Well, we've spoken of pluralism and relativity. The third one is specialization. That where life once had a wholeness and a seamless interconnectedness, modernity has dissected and diced social existence into all kinds of different components. Take, for example, just your teeth. They're assigned to some people who clean them, those are the hygienists, to those who fill them, those are dentists, those who pull them, those are oral surgeons, to those who cap them, those are cosmetic dentists, who straighten them, those are orthodontists, and who purchase them, that's the tooth fairy. So there are all kinds of specializations just for the teeth that are in your mouth. We moved our lives from the solidarity of a home to many specialized settings. There are birthing centers, hospital nurseries, daycare, then school, the mall, the spa, the grooming salon, the factory, the office, the golf course, the resort, the hospital, the counseling center, of course, the surgery center, the cardiac unit, the oncology center, the hospice, and the funeral parlor. And then finally, a commercial cemetery, perhaps, like Forest Lawn, the most famous one in Southern California. We learn to separate life into all kinds of sectors. What's religious, what's politics, what's medicine, what's economy, what's leisure, what's education, what's work, and what's therapy. And each has its own cadre of specialists. And life, then, is also broken up into stages. There are seasons, there are passages, there are crises that you must face as you move throughout your life. It was 2 weeks ago that I went through my midlife crisis. It was about an hour and a half long. But, you know, you have one of those that you must deal with. We even have to go through the stages of death and dying. And if I die in denial, I get a D. If I die in acceptance, I get an A. So everything can be specialized and graded. And the final thing is futurity that I want to comment on. No, two more. A couple more about these elements. Futurity, you see, in traditional society, one's past was behind one, and as you aged, you moved back to join your ancestors. And so there was a solidarity of all who have gone before you, who are there. And so the future lay behind you, and you handled it with the kind of respect of solidarity with those who have prized and valued what you also prize and value. Whereas today the future lies out before us, and it's something to be controlled and designed. The capricious destiny is to be mastered by us all. And so we feel ourselves cut off from what once supported us and driven into what we do not know and do not understand, but find that we must manipulate. The fourth of these characteristics is individuation. That where once in traditional society people were persons, they've tended to become individuals, obviously. The solidarity, both secure and stifling, of connectedness to family and kin and clan and village and tribe, offered an identity through the social bonding that was ethically binding and, of course, at times also ethnically binding and blinding. Modernity has instead created a macrame of relational ties, and the knots are really quite loose. We can untie them. They're easily untied because the individual has become a supreme reality. And to doubt the supremacy of the individual is the cardinal and unpardonable sin of our age, because the individual is to seek self-actualization. In the age of autonomy, the commitments are all those things that I must reshape by finding myself in achieving fulfillment and love and work. And the final quality of this whole period is that of interiority. That is, identity for the modern Western person has become so incredibly differentiated, just like the specialization of the world outside, highly specialized inside. And this radical differentiation means that we view ourselves so differently internally than what was viewed a few centuries ago. Peter Berger has described this rather well. Let me do the six steps that he has outlined. He says that a pluralism of social worlds around us in modern society has replaced the single coherent world that seemed firm and inevitable in traditional society. And so once where I lived in a small community surrounding a small Mennonite church called Pike Mennonite Church, with people whose, well, I knew the sins of their grandparents because the gossip and the stories were told generation after generation, and I knew the virtues of generations before. There was a single solidaire world that was there. Now I live in a world that is highly pluralistic, incredibly varied, with multiple cultures surrounding me in my intimate neighborhood in the little college town of Claremont, California. Winnipeg is amazing like that as well. Children in Southern California speak 125 different languages before they start to school. That is, varied children's cover all those 125. And I presume in Winnipeg, it's probably 75 to 80, maybe 100 different languages. Incredible variety that surrounds us at all times. So the pluralism of the modern social setting has replaced the single coherent world that seemed firm and inevitable. And secondly, the structures of each particular world in the pluralistic situation are experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. And so the experience of their vulnerability and their overlapping boundaries relativizes every one of them. And third, the institutional order of marriage and family and community and society undergoes a certain loss of reality, because the accent of reality consequently shifts from the objective order of the institutions, that this is marriage and this is society and this is family and this is church, to a realm of subjectivity and personal interiority. It moves inside the self. And so four, the individual's experience of the self becomes more real than the experience of the objective social world. I mean, my experience is far more real than the world itself in this new age. And so the person seeks to find a foothold in reality within themselves rather than within the community. Berger elsewhere has described this as the movement from honor to dignity. That traditionally, a society that valued honor recognized that the stuff of honor was actual between myself and another person. And if I dishonor you, I have actually injured you and your possessions and your world. And you have the right to reclaim your honor by some action in return. That, of course, has been a dominant motif in the larger Mediterranean world, according to Pierre Bourdieu. And we have seen the descriptions of that in the news attempting to analyze what's taking place in the former Yugoslavia, where a predominant honor system is still struggling to try and make some ethnic clarity out of ways that violate one another's honor. In contrast, we've moved through much of the Western world to a view of dignity. A view of dignity says that no matter what you do to despoil my honor, you can't touch my dignity. One of our great prophets, the singer Whitney Houston, says, no matter what you say and do to me, you can't take away my dignity, because my dignity is mine. It's now individualized. The foothold in reality is inside. It's no longer between. I was talking about this in class last Monday, and afterward, a student whose father is Japanese and whose mother is American, who defied her father's choice that she go to university and get an education that would actually make money, and went with her mother's choice and has come to seminary, came up and said, oh my land, what is the footnote for Peter Berger? I must read that, because my father lives totally by honor and my mother lives totally by dignity. and they don't communicate well on this, and I've chosen the dignity route, and I'm here in seminary, but I can't make peace with my father yet, who feels that I've dishonored him by doing this, because they're radically different understandings from a society with social solidarity and one with the advanced individualism. So the foothold with dignity turns inward. The sense of who I am is on my own integrity and my own interiority. And so, fourth, the individual's experience of self becomes far more real than this experience of the social world. The foothold reality is inside the self. And fifth, the individual's subjective reality, what's commonly described as their own psychology or the study of the psyche, becomes increasingly differentiated, complex, and interesting to the self. And at last, subjectivity, interiority, and exploration of a differentiated, elaborated psyche require previously unconceived depths. That is, the study of one's own inside becomes so utterly fascinating because I can now name parts and create mythologies or adapt other people's mythologies to explain who I am within. If, for example, I see a Jungian therapist, I come to understand that David, that is presented to you right now, is only a persona. You just heard it described wonderfully by John Neufeld, but it's false, it's phony, it's not true. It's just the fragmentary picture that's on the outside. But inside that, there's a real David who is seeking to be a person with some integrity. But that David that's right behind that public persona that you see, by choosing to be what he chooses to be, casts a shadow of all the things that he chooses not to be. And so that shadow is right behind him. And it moves, of course, you know, as a shadow does with the speed of light. And so it's always there, right behind. And that shadow, all the things that he represses or denies or avoids, and that's likely to erupt because it's also a part of him. And behind that shadow lies his struggle to be a man as over against his desires also to have some of the characteristics that are present in women. But his society tells him since he's born a man, he must be a man. And so his anima and animus are struggling. And beneath that at the center, there's a true self. At the center of that, there's a point of contact for God. And then behind that lie the archetypes that are a part of the richness of the cultural heritage and perhaps even transcultural. Oh my, how fascinating to go exploring inside and discover all of these. A very Western process. Or if we were to take a Freudian metaphor for this, well, we begin to understand that there are structural differences inside with our own economy that must be dealt with seriously, that there's an ego ideal that one gained from the mother that shames one, and a super ego that one gained from the father that invites guilt for oneself. But there are these incredible impulses under the floor, the id, it, as he said, that keeps erupting. And in between is this poor, tortured I, the ego, and it's trying to stand on top of all of those incredible impulses and drives with the guidance of these other two major figures. And so it develops a supervising ego, an observing self. It sits on the shoulder and becomes the wise one. I mean, you build these wonderful mythologies inside. My friend and colleague Al Duick, who teaches at the Mennonite Brethren Seminary in Fresno, says, we might far more wisely choose a model of ourselves that comes from the New Testament, an ecclesiology that is internalized, and understand ourselves as a church of persons within, that I am multiple within, not single. Well, he and I got into a long argument over that one night in the backyard of my house in a very Californian appliance called a spa. And as we sat there in the hot water discussing this, I said, then the real goal of life is not to have a narcissistic personality order instead of disorder, and to become a true narcissist who loves oneself fully and richly, and then learn secondarily to love your neighbor as yourself, as in pop psychology, which I disagree with, and I hope you do as well. But that seems to be the goal in so much Christian and non-Christian pop psychology, that the true goal is not to be a narcissist, as this whole age of autonomy has taught us, but the true goal is to have a multiple personality disorder turned into a correct order. Multiple personality order, that we have many, many people within us. And Al said, oh yes, and then you develop within yourself a pastoring center, someone who pastors the inner congregation. Well, that's an interesting model. Do you have a pastor within that pastors all of the subunits that are all of your experiences of energy, all of the sub-personalities? Well, Roberto Assagioli, the Roman Catholic psychoanalyst who was a friend of both Freud and Jung and Ranke, argued that we have multiple selves within and that we must develop a center self that pastors those, although he didn't use the word pastor. He was a committed Roman Catholic and and took his model somewhat, perhaps, from the church. Well, we could go on citing other people. Gurdjieff, the Russian philosopher, talked about many selves. There are those who debate that, whether it is possible to have not a single self, because the brain is not a single organ, is it? It's multiple organs that communicate with each other. Rather than a single organ, maybe the self is not a single unitary phenomena and not meant to be. Maybe there are multiple ones, but there should be a pastor. We see all of these are the kind of questions we raise in an age where interiority has become far more fascinating to us. And counseling, pastoral counseling, or Western psychotherapy as a whole, has been grounded in basic premises that internal interiority is the way to work at healing. Whereas throughout much of the world, it is the healing that happens between, as well as what happens within. And we return to that to talk about the uniqueness of pastoral counseling. But Western counseling has grounded on the basic premise of the autonomy of the individual, with the assumptions that we might say our corollaries are that the individual can create personal meaning independent of social entanglements of the self, by oneself, for oneself, out of oneself. That the personality can separate from binding family emotional heritage by writing off others, moving away, rising above. That freedom and growth come from cutting loose from imperfect parents and less than perfect siblings and from the old family roles and finding oneself. That the individual has the power to look unafraid at the insecurities of a helpless childhood through the wisdom of adult rationalization. That the individual has the transcendence to view the crises of life objectively and dispassionately. That the individual has the capacity to channel sexuality, aggression, rage, egotism, and greed toward creative goals through self-knowledge. And the individual can face suffering without avoidance, death without denial. And all this rises from the individual powers of the fully actualized and autonomous self. Robert Bella, who is one of our interesting critics, a sociologist, an Episcopalian layperson, who along with a team of five other sociologists put together some were psychologists and sociologists and a social scientist of other perspectives, put together the book called Habits of the Heart. Some of you may have read it. It's an analysis of individualism in Western society using the American experiment as the particular example. And he concludes partway through that book that much of the thinking about the self of educated Western people, such as you and me, is based on inadequate social science, impoverished philosophy, and vacuous theology. He says there are truths that we do not see when we adopt the language of radical individualism. We find ourselves not independently of other people and of institutions, but we find ourselves through them. We never get to the bottom of ourselves on our own. We discover who we are face to face and side by side with others in work and in love and in learning. We're not simply ends in ourselves, either as individuals or as a society. We're parts of a larger whole that we can neither forget nor imagine in our own image without paying a high price. If we're not to have a self that hangs in the void, slowly twisting in the wind, these are issues we cannot ignore. Well, it is out of the work of Bella that I want to draw for a few moments on four basic themes that he suggests have become givens in Western society, and that we as persons involved in pastoral care and in pastoral counseling have something significant that speaks to, that actualizes alternate ways of being that I want to stress as we focus more toward the understanding of what pastoral presence is about. We as pastoral people, in contrast to the society that is constantly urging us to disconnect, have a theology that suggests that it is in connecting and reconnecting with other persons that we find integrity, that we find authentic understandings of selfhood, that we become fully who we can be in maturity before God and with others. So the pastoral counselor begins by challenging four of the basic assumptions that lie at the heart of our culture, according to Bella and Associates. I'll list these four. Number one is that you only become mature as you develop the capacity to truly leave home. You must leave home. And secondly, you only become actualized as a person when you have left church, because your values are only your own when you have preferentially chosen them. And thirdly, it is your task to find yourself. And fourthly, then, you choose arbitrarily, but by your own preferences, a community that would be your community. And these become the norm of maturation for Western civilization and Western life. And let me challenge those for a moment, as you are already or have often in your life. First of all, a pastoral counselor refuses this magical necessity of leaving home. Though where our culture stresses the all-important necessity of leaving home, not just physically, but emotionally, relationally, we challenge those assumptions. The childhood is seen chiefly in our culture as preparation for the all-important event of at last being able to leave home, that separation and individuation come to a head in adolescence, when independence is only achieved then at last by stepping out. Now, both of these are issues that have to be faced by human beings in all cultures, but only in Western culture have we come to see it as such a unique separating of the self that I no longer need to sustain intimate, emotional, and valid connectedness. It's an evolution of individualism and self-reliance. My oldest daughter is a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania. She's studying anthropology. And she said to me a few weeks ago that her professor unabashedly said, if you're going to be a significant thinker in the world of anthropology, the first step is that you've got to leave home, leave community, leave whatever religious background you have, and become alienated from it so that you are truly an outsider and can view it dispassionately and with a perspective that has cut itself off from all of the old ties. Only then can you be a truly objective observer. And he told about his own journey and his alienation from family and community. And then he said, I'm curious how it is here in this class of graduate students. What have you happened? And one by one, as they went around, they told about their separation, their distancing, their cutting off, their leaving behind home and church and community so that they could be clear in what they saw and how they experienced it. And then he came to my daughter and she said, well, I'd like to say that this hasn't happened for me, but I think it's because I grew up as a Mennonite in a Mennonite community, and I've always been a part of a counterculture. And so I've always been doing that. I've always been critical of the culture around me. She said, before I went to school, when I was just turning 6 years of age, my father sat down with me and said, now, Debbie, you're going to discover that the first day of school, they'll ask you to put your hand on your heart and to recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, and they'll ask you to memorize this. Now, that's up to you, but I just want to tell you that I was told when I went to school that I was never to do that. You don't do that here in Canada, do you? That's an American ritual of worship that we do at the beginning of school every morning. And so I told her that my parents and my older siblings had told me, you just don't do this because you're a Mennonite and you're a pacifist. You know, non-resistant is the word we used then. And so you don't pledge allegiance to the flag. And so I said to her, it's okay with me if you just put your hand on your heart like everybody else, but don't bother to say it because that's not who you are. And the class looked at her and they said, you've never pledged allegiance to the flag? And she said, no. And I'm on the other end of the phone and she's telling me, I said, Deb, you've never pledged allegiance to the flag? She said, no. I said, you never told me that that's what you did. Well, she said, that's what you told me before I went to school and I didn't do it. And so she said, I knew I was counterculture right from the start. And so I didn't have to leave in order to have some way of looking at my culture with critical eyes. Well, when she finished, they all looked at her a little puzzled, and then they went on to the next two. And then they came to, I'm forgetting his first name, Lichty. I know his parents well. That's part of being in the Mennonite community, right? Another Mennonite from Goshen, whose parents, Russ and Marge, are on the faculty at Goshen College. And I can't think, I'll call him Paul, whatever his name is. And Paul said, well, I'm like Deb. I grew up in the Mennonite community, and we spent time in Nepal, we spent time elsewhere in the world, and so I've always been part of this counterculture as well, and I didn't have to really leave, and I still experience solidarity. I connect closely with my parents and my family. When I go home, I go to church, and I'm welcomed back by people that I've known, and that's part of who I am. And then someone said, aha, I got it, you're both from Goshen, Indiana. It's a uniqueness of that community. And they said, no, they're not. Because my daughter said, I only lived there 2 years. We moved there and then I went off to college, so it's not really that community. It's something different of understanding about how you become a person. Well, I would wish that everyone that grew up in a Christian community would have that kind of sense of continuity, but it isn't true. Where I teach in a evangelical culture in Southern California, I discovered that leaving home is very precious and very dear to people's hearts. And that leaving church, a high percentage of the students are not in the same denomination that their parents are. They've found another that they feel is perhaps closer to their own faith commitment because they've left home and they have left church. Now, a pastoral counselor reconnects where possible with a faith community and invites the person to journey back and to reconnect with those persons. The American tradition and the Canadian tradition to a large extent requires leaving church, that in late childhood or adolescence one must decide what church will be one's own, choose one's own God, one's own ultimate ends, one's faith and values, whatever they shall be. And the notion that one discovers one's deepest beliefs through tradition and community is just not congenial to us in the West any longer. We imagine instead this autonomous self existing independently, entirely outside any tradition or community, and then perhaps choosing one that is attractive to us. And this religious individualism has a long, long history in Western society. In my own country, it has its roots, for example, in the attitudes of people in the generation of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson once said, "I'm a sect myself." Or Thomas Paine, who said, "My mind is my church." Or one of my philosopher heroes, Alfred North Whitehead, who once said, "Religion is what one does with one's solitariness and one's solitude." But then toward the end of his life, he suggested that what you do if you're religious is you connect your solitude with that of others, which brings us back toward community. I was citing Bella, and he tells about interviewing a woman named Sheila who said, "My religion is Sheilaism. It's my own little voice. I try to love myself and be gentle with others, to take care of myself and to take care of others. That's my religion." Thirdly, a pastoral counselor is concerned not so much on people simply finding themselves in isolation, but in finding themselves again in that connectedness with family and with church and with community. That the view in Western society that at last you find yourself as a separate and distinct person with little continuity to one's roots and consciousness, to make something yourself through career choice and successful work and pursuing advancement and winning status and demonstrating competency and expanding power and achieving social standing and prestige and winning your own self-esteem is not the goal that one finds when you find your roots in a pastoral setting that has its values embedded in what you see as wholeness, not as discrete, separated selfhood, but as wholeness from a different vision, a different image. And so, finally, the fourth of these characteristics is that one at last must choose community, that the pastoral counselor suggests that community is not an option to be selected at the end, but it's something that comes to us as a gift. Not a social enclave that we select. Bell and Associates said that the community that most Westerners choose is not truly a community any longer. It's a lifestyle enclave, as you pick the people that like the same leisure activities that you like, that enjoy the same style of life, and you live with them until you can afford a better one. And then you discard that lifestyle enclave and move up to a superior one that is more attractive and more advantageous to you. I once taught at a Baptist seminary in the Chicago area, and an introduction to what American Baptists are like, Brian Archibald, the philosopher, theologian, president, who really had wanted always to be a mathematician, said, "Now, first sit down, I want to tell you about American Baptists, because as a Mennonite, you're going to have to learn to know us." He said, "American Baptists are the most American group in the whole population. The most American because we are truly an escalator denomination. We evangelize people who have no rootedness and no connectedness. We put them on a economic, educational, and social escalator. As they mature in their Christian life, they gradually climb the economic and social escalator in the society. And by the time they're at midlife, they leave the American Baptist Church and become Episcopalians. They get off the escalator. And so we are constantly bringing people in at the bottom and sending them into the Presbyterian, Episcopal, or some other church that will give them more prestige at the top." He said, "My favorite example, this is the man who said, 'I want you to know I was born a Baptist, raised a Baptist, baptized a Baptist, married a Baptist. I will live as a Baptist and die as a Baptist because I have no ambition at all.'" He said, That's the contrasting viewpoint, because we are truly an escalator sort of group. Well, in contrast to that, we say that community is not to be used loosely and freely and tossed about, because what many people experience is not community. A community is an inclusive whole of differing people committed to interdependence in both public and private life and honoring each other's callings and living together with a solidarity of respect and mutuality. Instead, our society is offered as this narcissistic, segmented society where you can choose a lifestyle enclave that you like that you appreciate, that you enjoy, a kind of collective support for individualists that allows individualists to fill out their lives with other individualists, but without ever really breaking that and becoming a part of it. Well, as you can hear, I've been arguing that a pastoral counselor is someone who is profoundly committed to connectedness. Connectedness to family, connectedness to community, and connectedness within that to a people who are called the people of God. That this is what is the unique thing that makes a pastoral counselor pastoral. Ed Wimberly, African-American pastoral counselor, in his definition says, pastoral counseling is the dimension of liberation ministry of the church that's based upon a relationship between a pastor who has counseling skills and a person or family who seeks out the pastor because they're in need of the pastor's counseling skills. But this relationship has a definite structure and is based upon certain agreed upon goals. And moreover, there's an expectation on the part of the pastor and the clients that the tradition of the church and its resources, the solidarity of the community that surrounds them, will be brought to bear into the counseling relationship and upon whatever needs there are in the person who seeks help. You catch that sense of African-American solidarity that is there, that is often missing when you are talking primarily with Anglo or white persons who are reflecting on the nature of this. Because community is widely and usefully used, but to talk about community as referring definitely to the people of God, the family of God, God's new people, who have a citizenship in heaven, who are God's own people, and that we're inviting people to join that circle and to become a part of that, comes as a bit of a surprise. Now, traditionally, pastoral counseling, following William Klebsch and Charlie Jekyll, one of my teachers back east long ago, in their book on history of pastoral care and counseling, was said to have a series of simple functions that took place within the body of the community with increased intensity as you moved from pastoral care to pastoral counseling. And these were healing, sustaining, guiding, and reconciling. The healing is a response to woundedness. It's repairing damage and restoring health. And sustaining is supporting persons as they endure and transcend difficult circumstances and situations in life. And that guiding seeks to aid people in their choice-making and their problem-solving and their goal-setting and in their ethical boundary definition. And reconciliation seeks to reconnect people, reconnect broken relationships between persons and between persons and God. And that various groups, various situations, various ethnic orientations will specialize in different ones of these. Ed Wimberly once commented that among African-American churches, it is guiding and sustaining that have been the dominant functions. The reconciliation took a secondary place, and healing became very difficult because of the racial climate, which meant that the woundedness continued and was always there and had to be lived with, and that people needed sustaining support. They needed guidance and hope in the present while making the most of situations that were constant woundedness that showed little sign of alleviation. And so pastoral care and counseling, he said, among black Christian leaders had to be predominantly guidance and sustaining. In contrast, when you read the writings of those who write from the viewpoint of Anglos, European-American backgrounds, you'll find that healing has been the dominant function. That the absence of economic and political and social oppression, after all, we are the oppressors, and so that makes it easier for us, has made the other functions less necessary. And so the Freudian captivity in the 40s and 50s, and then the Rogerian captivity in the 60s and 70s, as different theories became the dominant ones, focused on one-to-one healing models that required clinical training and economic resources and multiple staff. But we have come to recognize that all four of these are necessary parts of our care, and that in focusing on healing, we tend to teach people how to get private healing, how to have reconciliation to happen in their own inner life, and we psychologize so that it became a private process, and that the pastoral mode is to invite people back to community relationship, to connectedness, to accountability with other people within community, so that healing can help bring us once more into a sense of some solidarity with other people that are important and significant people in our lives. Well, in an age of fragmentation, an age of autonomy, an age of increased relativity, an age of crazed interiority, an age of rugged individualism, an age that moves us increasingly to have more rigid boundaries between ourselves and others, an age that slices us off from tradition, we must find ways to reconnect once again with the traditions that can mold and shape us and the communities that bear those forward. Or we're left alone. We're left isolated. There's a fascinating book called Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, written by Yaffa Eliak, maybe you've seen it, a teacher in New York City, who began observing that his children that he taught, who had come from the Hasidic community, told tales from their parents and their grandparents, particularly those who had survived the Holocaust, that were phenomenal, and he began to write them down. And one of those tales was about tradition. He defined tradition as a running start on reality. There's an old Zen Buddhist koan that says, before you can leap, you must first crouch. That is, you have to get some small start before you can make the leap. And he described tradition as that gives you a whole running start on reality. And then he told the story from one of the wise old rabbis in the Hasidic community in New York. This rabbi had been imprisoned in one of the major concentration camps, Auschwitz, and then moved to a small road camp in the outskirts, where he, along with a number of other people that were still more healthy and had resilience in their muscles, could go out and work on the damage to the roads, particularly bombing damage toward the end of the war. And so they would spend their days filling in bomb craters on the road. And the rabbi worked alongside a Jewish businessman who had become agnostic, individualist, isolated. He argued that there was no way to believe in a God who allowed such tragedies as what was taking place all around them, the genocide and the destruction of all that they had loved and known. And the rabbi said, I cannot give up believing because I believe because I must. I am a part of a community of belief and I cannot lose that. And they would debate that day after day. And one evening toward the end of their time in the road camp, toward the end of the war, they returned back to the camp for the night, and they saw that a bomb had dropped in the courtyard and blasted a hole some 15 feet across and quite deep. And as they went in for the night, they realized how vulnerable they were, even though in a concentration camp. But they discovered how vulnerable when at midnight they were called out in their night clothes, and the announcement was given that they were going to be tested by forcing them to run across the yard and leap across this hole. And those that did not make it to the far side would use it as their burial place. Then they saw that machine guns had been set up on either side of it. And the businessman said, Rabbi, we're tired and we're weak. What will we do? And he said, we will run and we will pray and we will leap. And so when the command was given, the group ran in twos and threes across the yard and jumped for the far side. And as the businessman and the rabbi approached the hole, he heard the rabbi say, oh God, I'm leaping. And a moment they landed on the far side. And the businessman said, Rabbi, we made it. How did you do it? And he said, I ran and I prayed and I jumped and I held onto the shirt tail of my father and my mother and my grandfather and my grandmother and my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother, and they carried me across. And then he said to the businessman, and how did you make it? And he said, Rabbi, I was holding onto your shirt tail. Well, Eliak says, that's what tradition is. It gives us something to hold to that is tested, a solidarity to define the self, so that I don't define myself only by internal mythology, by what is within, but I define myself also by what is between, that I am connected to other persons, and I know those connections. And so the pastoral counselor, representing a community of faith, knowing that their credentials are in who they are as one that is called by the people of God, ordained by the people of God, commissioned to be available to support and to guide and to reconcile and to heal, is there to say, you belong to this community and you can join a tradition that stands with you, that supports you. Now, traditionally, we have said that a pastoral counselor presents a caring self that represents the community that's failed them. And that is true. But the pastoral counselor presents a caring self that also represents the community that's not only failed them, but has also formed them, and that has matured and nurtured and supported and helped them to this point as well. And so rather than alienating them from the community in the hopes that this will bring healing, the pastoral counselor clarifies, but also reconnects and says that the community that you've grown up in, the people that you've known, are formative and you need them as well. And if you've found that that community has failed you in some ways, you can still connect to it while you find other communities of faith that support and surround you. So where the social context of the person is not offered the acceptance or the integrity that the person requires, the pastoral therapist and counselor's integrity can surround and support and invite only in the one-to-one, but it requires a community that can reach out and be there and be present as well. Well, having described all of this, I'm suggesting that central to being pastoral is recognizing that presence is the virtue that lies at the core. So at last I come back to my title after a long introduction. It is my colleague at Fuller, James McClendon, who in his book on ethics has suggested that one of the primary virtues we don't speak about in the Christian community is the virtue of presence. That it is a virtue that shapes character. And that when one has developed within community that has been present to you, the capacity to extend that presence to welcome others, that there is a moral character to that, an ethical character that says that I choose to be there with empathy and with compassion and with caring and with understanding to connect with you. And that as I do that, it is not simply because I have learned all of the skills by careful counselor training, but because I represent a community that also reaches out in its own fragmentary and at times alienated or faltering or failing way to be present to other persons. For community is persons who have committed themselves to be present with one another, who share a common virtue of recognizing it is in presence, it is in withness, it is in our standing with one another. My text for this morning is not a verse, but it's a word. My text this morning is that unusual word with. The word with that you recognize in presence where the Lord God walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the garden. But more difficult than that, it's that strange words that you find when it says, and Potiphar took Joseph and threw him into prison, and the Lord was with him there. James Sanders at School of Theology Claremont says, what is this nonsense of a God who goes to prison? If this nonsense goes on, it will say that God was not only there with this poor slave in an Egyptian prison, but this God was with those people when they were in captivity in Palestine. Or if this nonsense go on, it would imply that God might have been with this strange carpenter who is nailed on the cross. That, you know, where does it end? But yet, that is the heart of it. It's that this. It is God with us. It is our calling to be truly with other persons. It is that profound longing that is in Paul in virtually all of his epistles, that I long to be with you, that recognizes the virtue of being genuinely present, undergirds what we do, not as individual talent or skill in learned arts of empathy, but in the withness that says, I'm here as the face of a caring community, and I offer to you what little fragment of that is possible for me, but invite you to come on in and join the fragmented community of fragmented persons who find wholeness in connecting with one another and are willing to pay that cost by being present within community with each other. Well, I do have one more tale of that. It's a tale that long ago in a distant land, there was a prince who dreamed of a community, not a kingdom, a land in which all persons were actually committed to each other in loyalty and in love and acceptance, and where every person sought the welfare of others as well as their own welfare, even at times at some cost to themselves, because presence required that willingness to pay that cost. And so the prince called a gathering of all of the leaders, all the heads of clans, all the wise and trusted people of the land. Each was invited to come to the foundation of a new society where they would covenant to live together in caring community. And he said, as a symbol, since this is a great wine-growing region, I'm going to ask you all to bring a bottle of your own best wine, and that at the end of the time, we will share a glass of joint wine, because we will all pour them in one giant vat, just as our lives should all be blended, and we'll all drink a toast to this new community from the common wine that everyone has prepared. So bring your very best vintage. One of the persons invited to this covenanting, to this community, found himself just astounded at this invitation to such inclusion. He said, it's too much of a loss of my own self to pour my wine into the vat with all the wine of my neighbors and their vineyards. It's an amalgamation into a common kind of human mass, a common kind of ego mass, One blended communal wine with none of the individuality of the vintner, the unique variety of the grapes, the special year that I grew it in, the late harvest with its high density of sugars, the irreducible or irreproducible flavor and bouquet, the lovely color, the indefinable magic. That's impossible, he said. I won't do that. I wouldn't waste my best wine to pour it into everybody else. I'll know what I'll do. I'll fill a bottle with water and I'll cork it. And when the time comes, I'll go up and pour my bottle of water in, and no one will be any the wiser. And so the conference was held. The conversational community took place. And there were those tentative commitments of everybody to cooperate with the prince. And at last they came forward and took their glasses to drink the communal toast. And when they lifted their glasses to their lips, they discovered that it was nothing but water. No one in the whole kingdom had been willing to pay the price of community. Only if you and I are willing to and allow ourselves to commit our lives into solidarity with others, do we become the kind of invitation to other people to say, come and trust, come and reconnect, because it's a fragmented, highly preferential world where people choose their values because they like them. It is a cybernetic, highly relative, closed, distancing community that we are moving toward and we are already well into in our Western cultures. In the midst of that, we offer, as pastoral care people, as pastoral counselors, as pastoring persons, what people hunger for. A connectedness that is made authentic and real because it's in a circle around one who offers that which transcends life and death. We're in a circle around Jesus. We have a community that has its own center, a center that invites it to a different quality of life. And so I say to you, my friends, go from town to town, go from street to street, go from one person to another, and keep telling the tales of God's community, the healing tales of what it is to reconnect once more in an age of autonomy, and shout with all your might, good people, do not forget. What is at stake is your life. It's your survival. Do not forget. Do not forget.